just a very special season and a very special state tournament. I think we qualified 8 kids that year, and we placed 5 kids. But we had some kids that were just wrestling out of their league, out of their to what they've been wrestling all year, and kids that we had been losing to in the season, in the regular season, we'd step out on the mat in that state tournament, and we'd beat them. And we pulled some really big upsets.
That's Andy Nemchek. We'll hear more from him coming up on our Coaches Week Rewind to discuss his coaching career and certainly one of the highlights, Beloit State Champions of 2010. They shared the title with Smith Center that year, and that was Coach Nemchek talking about how his wrestlers that year just elevated the way they wrestled against people that maybe they lost to earlier in the year, and they got it done in crunch time, and that's a big reason why they were successful that year and winning a share of the state championship. So Coach Nemchek will join us coming up in a little bit. Coming up tomorrow, Mike Weatherman, former head coach at Sylvan Lucas, Sylvan Unified, who coached about every sport imaginable. Did he coach rugby? Is that true? and tennis? But he coached everything, and he's very successful in everything that he coached. He is certainly a coaching icon in North Central Kansas. Kirk Christians will join us on Friday, head coach of St. John's Tipton in Lakeside formerly, and still helps coach now at Beloit, assistant coach for the basketball team this past few years. And if you missed John Bingesser on Monday and Roger Barta yesterday, those are both Kansas Hall of Fame coaches that we talked to. And if you missed those interviews, you can go back and listen to them at our Sports Ticket podcast page at our website, kdcountry94.com. Local sports, anything else to add in regards to anything? No, senior spotlight coming up tomorrow, possibly?
Yeah, right. Should have that tomorrow. And everything else, anything else we've talked local, go to ncksports.com.
All right, we start with the news that came out yesterday out of South Carolina. Kansas City Chiefs corner Breshad Breland was arrested in York, South Carolina on Tuesday. Breland was arrested on 5 charges: resisting arrest, transporting alcohol in a motor vehicle with the seal broken, open container of beer or wine in a motor vehicle, possession of 28 grams or less of marijuana or 12 grams of hash, and driving without a license. He was booked in Charlotte, North Carolina, Tuesday afternoon. A source with the Chiefs told the Kansas City Star they are aware of the situation. Bashan Breland has posted on his Twitter account, and I quote, "A lot of people want to speculate on my situation and don't know the facts. I really was at a gas pump, got approached by 2 guys. Police pulled up. They throw something into my car as police pulled up, which the cops saw, and I was the one detained with charges that really shouldn't be charged." Okay, without knowing all the particulars, how do you get the other charges? Like resisting arrest, alcohol in a motor vehicle, which that can happen. I mean, that's just basically, he had an open container. I mean, let's be honest. That's really what it is.
Yeah.
And so is it the pot or the hash that was thrown into his car that the cop saw? And why would you actually be arrested if a cop saw that? I'm confused.
Yeah,
I'm confused. But I don't know all the details either. And I'm not saying that Bashan Breland did all the stuff he was arrested for, or if this is going to be, you know, something that's a misdemeanor when it's all said and done and the Chiefs, you know, suspend him for a game. I don't think anything big's going to come out of this, is what I'm going to say. I don't think Bashan Breland is going to be, I don't think he's going to be cut from the team because of this.
No.
I don't think.
No.
Unless there's more to it.
No. There's got to be something bigger probably than this for a first-time offense on the Chiefs, you know, for them to be like, no, we're going to get rid of you.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're could easily be a suspension by the Chiefs of the league or something that could come out of this. But as the way we see it right now, I don't see any kind of see you later type of deal. But
Breland signed a 1-year deal with the Chiefs this offseason worth $4.5 million. So we'll see how the Chiefs handle it. And they're going to let, of course, it run its course in the legal system before really making a decision. They don't have to make any kind of decisions. But once again, there's last year, the offseason situation with Tyreek Hill, which was a much bigger deal.
Yeah.
Not trying to underestimate the significance of being arrested, but I do think that there's more to the story. And I will say this, when athletes go on social media to defend themselves very quickly and give details, I tend to believe the athlete a little bit more. But when an athlete just simply says, I had no knowledge that was in my system, I don't believe them at all.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, come on. But he gives specifics here. And I don't know. And if he made it up and it's a lie that he just put on Twitter, then he makes the situation even worse.
Yeah.
So well, I don't think Breland's that stupid, but maybe he is. I think this is not going to be as big as it may have sounded when people heard about it last night.
Yeah, well, the resisting arrest could have easily been, hey, this isn't mine. They came by and the police didn't see it.
Right.
You know, they came by, threw this stuff into my vehicle and ran off. Mm-hmm. This isn't me. I didn't do it. It's not mine. And that easily could turn into resisting arrest.
Right. Because, but if a cop saw it, though, based on what he said, you would be like, well, I could see why he resisted arrest because he didn't.
Same thing the other way.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. We'll see how it all plays out.
I wonder if there was a security camera, you know, at the place, you know.
That's what people have been saying on social media is there cameras at the gas pump to prove that what you said is right. Because if what you put on Twitter is out there and you find out he was lying, that makes him look even worse. Uh-huh. So to me, my point is what's there to gain by him putting out in social media? It's that he basically wants people to know this isn't exactly what happened. You're not getting all the information. I applaud him for that, although in some cases he probably shouldn't put anything out there because to defend himself and so forth if he has to get to that point, if there is some kind of trial or something, which I don't think is going to happen either. Okay, Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and NBA have contingency plans in place to start a season whenever they are allowed to restart. And here's the most realistic plan right now. The realistic time range for opening day for Major League Baseball is now somewhere between middle of June and July 4th, in the view of most officials, which would allow for an 80 to 100 game regular season with the schedule running through October. An expanded postseason at neutral sites might follow, with the World Series ending in late November or early December. Of course, why would they go neutral sites that late in the year? Oh, pretty simple, you know. If the Royals are in this thing, the weather could be bad. You don't want to have, you know, postseason games where it's 5 degrees above zero or something like that. So that's why they're thinking about it. The goal for owners and players is to maximize the number of games in the season and thus maximize revenues, of course. At this point, playing half of the 162-game slate feels ambitious, but with larger rosters and perhaps more frequent scheduled doubleheaders, it is theoretically doable. Obviously, any postseason that stretches in the vicinity of Thanksgiving and beyond is going to require the use of ballparks and warm weather locales with retractable roofs, so forth and so on. Like the Yankees, I'd be pretty cold to play in December in New York. So, you know, these teams could obviously be giving up home field advantage.
Yeah.
As for breaking ground on the 2020 regular season, they're still considering three locations, Florida, Texas, and Arizona. So Major League Baseball still working on what they might do. And, of course, as we know, things change with every second and passing day. The National Football League has prepared contingency plans to preserve a full regular season calendar in 2020. And here's what we're hearing. They are planning on moving forward with a regular season, but possibly their start date will be moved back to October 15th. Normally, it would start the first week of September, typically. So that would be basically a 5 to 6 week delay to the regular season. The regular season then would be played with no bye weeks or Pro Bowl. There'd be no Pro Bowl. The Super Bowl would be on February 28th. So the Super Bowl would be about a month later, roughly 3 to 4 weeks later. The regular season would start October 15th, and there'd be no bye weeks. Okay, now, I'm just going to say right now there's a problem with this. But I don't know if the union protected themselves with the latest CBA. They added a game to the season.
Yeah.
And the reason, and the whole thing about the adding a game to a season was to have two byes. So that was part of it. Like, hey, if we're going to play an extra game, we need an extra bye. Did we want to protect the safety of the players? Is it really safe to play 17 straight games without a bye?
Does the 17th game start this year or not?
I'm pretty sure it started this year, but maybe not.
The playoff thing started this year, but the 17th
game started
the next year, I think.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because what I was reading was it was going to be a 16-game schedule.
Okay, okay. Well, that's fine. That works for me then.
But still,
there's no bye week. That's 16 in a row.
Yeah, which is not ideal.
That's not
ideal.
Not good either.
I wouldn't think. I think the players would want something. But, I mean, obviously, there's probably some things like contingencies in that.
Right.
That current CBA or whatever that they can probably work around it for 1 year.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ideal to have to do that without a bye.
No.
getting rid of the Pro Bowl means nothing.
No.
The bye weeks.
Yeah, the Pro Bowl does. Well, it does mean something in regards to they probably play games right up, and there'll be only 1 week between.
Probably so.
There won't be a 2 week hiatus between the Super Bowl and the conference title game. So they're just picking up that week by getting rid of the Pro Bowl to will they have playoff games. Probably.
Yeah.
They ain't gonna waste. They ain't gonna have a waste a whole week during this whole schedule.
I wouldn't think so.
No. But losing a Pro Bowl is no big deal, obviously. No. The NBA, they want to finish the rest of their season and start next season December, possibly. Man, this is going to be crazy, some of the things that are going to happen. It's going to throw our whole schedule and calendar just out of whack, isn't it? Adam Silver said on a teleconference call recently, our revenue, in essence, has dropped to zero. That's having a huge financial impact on the team business and the arena business. Silver also hinted at changes to the league's schedule, saying all rules are off at this point, while also confirming the NBA would play significantly later than June if games do resume. Doing so would mean pushing back or canceling remaining league events, which wouldn't be too much of a surprise with the pandemic pausing all major league sports in America. The biggest events that could change are the NBA Draft Combine, which was originally scheduled for next month in Chicago, the Summer League in Las Vegas. But if league owners are seriously considering resuming play without sacrificing games, pushing back the start of the 2020-21 regular season is almost inevitable. And if that happens, how does the league ever return to its current 82-game format? And would players ever agree to such a move? That will be interesting, because there's been this idea out there that, listen, we go ahead and start the regular season around Christmas next season. Is when we start it, and then we give people the break in between and so forth and so on if we're going to play all the way to, into the fall. You also then would have to possibly compete with the National Football League. See, there's crossover that can affect you revenue-wise as well.
There's some stuff that you're not going to be able to avoid if you want to play.
I mean, you could be looking at October, the NBA Finals. I mean, possibly. I mean, I'm not saying that's what they're talking about, but it's possible that you could look at October for the NBA Finals. You could be looking at the start of the NFL season middle of October, and you could look at Major League Baseball having the World Series in December.
Yeah. I don't know. How far do you go, like, in the NBA before you just say, this season's done?
I think you're getting close.
I just don't feel like they should even finish it. Yeah. If it's going to go into October. If they're talking about starting the next season in December, how can they realistically finish the season in October?
Here's what I think, and I know it would be a bummer for teams that were really close to getting a playoff spot, but you played 67 games, 65 games? They had 15, 17 left. Just don't even worry about the rest of the regular season.
No.
Well, but that's what they're talking about.
And that's what I don't understand.
I think what they're doing is they want to get back into regular season mode before you get into playoff mode, because you just suddenly come back. Playoff mode's a whole different level.
I
think that's what they're thinking. And I think they're also thinking, well, that at least gives those teams a chance that were right on the edge of making the playoffs to get in. It gives them. And I get that. But personally, to me, what's more important, the 2 weeks of a regular season or the postseason? And I like the idea where you just start with the best. You make it a best of five series the first round. Shorten the, or maybe all the series are best of five. Whatever they got to do, they shorten it. But I do think they need a few games before you just start playoffs.
Yeah, I get that.
And I think that's what they're saying is, listen, we only have 15 games left to play anyway. So we play two and a half weeks. That'd be a good way to get back in the flow of things. Mm-hmm. But I think then you have to shorten the playoffs a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't you?
That's in my mind is why I say that is the timeline of it.
Right.
It's not the,
sure.
that
somewhere
I don't
they
want
gotta,
to go
somewhere,
play the game.
Somewhere games. They got to squeeze time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know how they're going to do it. Because once you go longer than normal, then like they just said, the calendar is completely out of whack.
Yeah.
And then when do you start the next season? And then how do you ever get it back in line? I mean, eventually, at some point you have to shorten a season. Whether you do it now or you do it next year, if you want to get back on the regular calendar.
Yeah.
Unless this is just going to be the norm. I don't want their job. It's not easy.
Oh, absolutely not.
Not easy. All right. We've talked about The Last Dance on ESPN. Interesting stuff coming out about stuff that happened back in the late 80s and into the 90s with the Chicago Bulls. Roy Williams was on Colin Cowherd yesterday, I believe it was. And Roy Williams was one of the main guys that recruited Michael Jordan to North Carolina. Of course, Roy went on to be a great head coach at Kansas. And then, of course, at North Carolina still, he's a College Basketball Hall of Famer. He was an assistant with Dean Smith on his staff in 1982. And Roy Williams says that Michael Jordan ran a 4.38 in the 40-yard dash during his sophomore season, which would have been back around 1982. Williams recalled that it happened during a team practice at the beginning of the season. He told Jordan to run the 40-yard dash in hopes of being able to track the young star's growth between seasons, similar to how Williams would measure his player's height and weight each year. When the assistant coach's stopwatch read 4.38, he made Jordan run it again, this time with multiple people tracking the time. Jordan's response, too fast for you, huh? On the second run, the coaches were officially blown away. Williams says, and I quote, he goes back to the line, he runs the 40 again, and all of us got below 4.4. Now remember, this is the early 80s. Today is what, 2020? That would have been 35, 38 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
To put the 40-yard dash of Jordan's into perspective, only four prospects at the 2020 NFL Scouting Combine ran faster times than 4.38 in 2020. So I've heard this, well, Jordan, he wasn't as good an athlete. He wouldn't be as good now. He was ahead of his time then. He would fit in perfectly now.
Oh, yeah.
And now, would there be more guys there as athletic as him? Yeah, there'd be a few. Sure. But very interesting. In 1982, of course, the Tar Heels won the national championship. Jordan hit the big shot. But Jordan ran a 4.38, according to Roy Williams, in 1982 or 83, whatever that was.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That's pretty fast.
I would never dreamed of anything like that in my life. But
No. I could run it twice.
Impressive.
Not run it twice, but how would I would do that? I could run a 10-yard, and I can't. I did the 10-yard dash. I don't think I could do it in 4.3. Yeah, the 2 and 20, probably not. Okay, there's an article by Vincent Goodwill, never heard of him, from Yahoo Sports. He says, don't buy into Michael Jordan's narrative. The Bad Boys Pistons deserve your respect. I would say yes and no. I mean, we talked about it yesterday. I respect them. They won the world championships under the rules of the NBA at the time. Mm-hmm. They did what they had to do within the rules. Did they push the limit, push the envelope? No doubt. Boston Celtics played pretty rough. Remember McHale's clothesline on Kurt Rambis?
Mm-hmm.
Before the Celtics and Lakers, there were some really rough times for crying out loud in the NBA. So I get that. Pistons are probably the last team that was super physical with anybody or allowed to be that physical. The NBA changed some of their rules. And part of that was the NBA got to the point where the games are 78 to 76, and it's like, man, we want some offense. Now, of course, you can't hand check or not supposed to. They allow everybody to travel. James Harden can take five steps without dribbling the ball and get his bucket. I might be exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, it helps when you're able to travel almost every time.
Mm-hmm.
And this article from Mr. Goodwill from Yahoo Sports, this is what he says. I'd like to get your input on this. It is somewhat interesting. I've always said there's two sides to a story. I just wonder why this hasn't been brought up a lot sooner. So I am confused a little bit. But anyway, he says, this writer, that Michael Jordan's battles with the Pistons are legendary. And the way the story goes, Jordan's conquering of the Pistons in 1991 was met with disrespect from the Pistons in the waning moments of the Eastern Conference Finals. Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer led the Pistons in walking right past the Bulls without shaking their hands, an apparent high crime in those days. It appeared like bad form and bad sportsmanship from a team that tortured the Bulls in the 88, 89, and 90 playoffs. Jordan and the Bulls appear like the more mature bunch in the way it was framed, but the Jordan-sanctioned documentary misses a very important point that led to the walk-off. The Pistons are undeserving champions, Jordan said on the day between Games 3 and 4 in Detroit in 1991. The Bad Boys are bad for basketball, said Jordan. In that moment, Jordan reduced the Pistons to thugs, not as champions who had to plow their way through the toughest road in a golden era. Sure, Jordan shook the Pistons' hands in the years before, but his words invalidated those actions. The Pistons were tough, of course, but featured the greatest backcourt trio of all time. Okay, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. That's an opinion, I would argue. Mm-hmm. Isaiah Thomas, Joe DeMars, and reserve Vinnie Johnson. Laimbeer, Rick Mahorn, Dennis Rodman added defense, and it led to this uniquely built team storming through and winning two straight titles in 89 and 90. Jordan had problems guarding Thomas, Dumars, and Johnson, who were tough, but also potent offensive players that could get hot at any time. Age, injury, and years of battling the league's best caught up with the Pistons in 91, especially Thomas, who had wrist surgery that was supposed to end his season, and a sprained foot from the semifinals against the Celtics. It was the Bulls' time, and Jordan added more to it. Jordan's words stung the Pistons leading into the Game 4 finale, thus precipitating the walk-off. The Pistons were no angels, but they had never discussed the Lakers or the Celtics in that way publicly as Jordan had. The Pistons played them tough and physically, but there was a code of respect for the champions. Thomas won't say it now, but Jordan's comments played as big a factor in the Pistons leaving the floor with 7.9 seconds left in Game 4 as much as their public stance is today. that they only did to the Bulls would have been done to them in 1988 when they finally defeated the Boston Celtics to get to the finals. Accompanied by footage, Thomas brings up the Celtics walking off the floor at the Pontiac Silverdome in the final moments of Game 6 in 1988 with Kevin McHale on his way to the locker room while Adrian Dantley was at the free throw line. Larry Bird, the leader of the Celtics, hightailed it out of there without a word said to the Pistons, and the Pistons weren't complaining. It was the rivalry, physical and heated, and the Pistons were more concerned with getting to the finals and dealing with the dynastic Lakers. Jordan, true to form, was shown Thomas's comments in the doc in Calls Bull on him. Thomas said the regrets came from the aftermath when the Pistons were skewered in the media. John Sally and Joe Dumars shook hands with the Bulls on the way out, like McHale in 1988, but it doesn't hold weight in the eyes of the public. When the Bulls conquered the Pistons to take the mantle, it was met with rejoicing all around. Jordan finally getting to the finals after enduring so many years of defeats and questions and getting rid of the anti-hero bad boys. Led by Jordan's words, the narrative was set. The Pistons weren't respected as the proud, skillful champions they were, but only as an obstacle during Jordan's rise to greatness. It's only been recently said that the Pistons have gotten more credit, but at the same time, they didn't fit in the league's marketing plans. It was Magic, Bird, and then Jordan. Jordan has proved himself to be worth every bit of the hype he's received, stamping himself as the game's greatest player. Beating Jordan and being the team he lost to the most should enhance the Pistons' legacy and Isaiah Thomas's, but winning has cost them, unfortunately. The NBA didn't like the Pistons' style of play, even though the Celtics were just as tough and dirty and, as demonstrated in 1988, petty. The Celtics are woven in the fabric of the league with three titles in the 80s, but they never went back-to-back like the Pistons did. The Pistons are discussed like the 90s Knicks, a team that only beat you physically and couldn't win any other way. But while the Pistons played with more grace than those two who came after them, they weren't as glamorous as the Showtime Lakers or Celtics, who found a style that worked for them and proved to be entertaining as well. The league marketed the Pistons because they produced a reaction and were great foils, but didn't go as far as crowning them great champions. Jordan is lauded for finally getting past the Pistons, but the Pistons are merely relegated to second-class status when they should be celebrated the same way. A rivalry that produced great moments should have its story told in full, as opposed to the singular perspective we've been fed for 30 years. This is coming from Vincent Goodwill, who is a writer apparently for Yahoo Sports. Comments, thoughts.
Right at the end of that, what he said, I want to know, did he watch the Bad Boys documentary?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because that was more of praising what the Pistons were. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't about Michael Jordan. It wasn't about the Bulls. I mean, that was part of the documentary, right, obviously, because that's when the Bad Boys kind of ended, mm-hmm, and it started falling down at the end of that. But, there's some things in there I agree with for sure that, you know, they probably didn't get the respect that they deserved. And we talked about that yesterday,
yeah,
that they didn't get probably the respect they deserved as champions.
Right.
But as far as the way they played and the things that you reap what you sow, mm-hmm, it's what we talked about. You know, it's one of those deals where, you know, if you're going to play it like this, you got to be expected that people aren't going to like you, mm-hmm, that things are going to go the wrong way for you in the end of it, and that people are going to like that hero that rises up,
mm-hmm,
and knocks you from your perch, mm-hmm, if you play like that, mm-hmm, and if you act like that, mm-hmm, on the floor. Whether Michael Jordan said what he did, I don't know why Bill Laimbeer isn't coming out and saying those things. That's why he did it.
That's what I thought.
Isaiah's trying to take that line of, I'm sorry.
But
Bill Laimbeer is not. Some of those guys, it was just like, why don't they just come out and say that?
That's
what Jordan said the day before, so that's why we did it.
That's why
nobody said that in 30 years, if that's why they did it.
But that's why that's the one part that jumped out to me of the story is, the writer, Thomas won't say it now, but Jordan's comments played as big a factor in the Pistons leaving the floor than anything else. Okay, so why would Laimbeer and Thomas keep that a big secret? This would add to support them.
Exactly.
I mean, I've never heard Laimbeer say it.
No.
And I've never heard Thomas say it. And it's like, why won't they say it? Because, Jordan said this publicly. Apparently, he said this publicly. The Pistons obviously heard it. And I'll go through the words again. The Pistons are undeserving champions. Jordan said it on the day between games 3 and 4 in Detroit in 1991. The Bad Boys are bad for basketball, which a lot of people thought agree with Jordan on
that. Yeah, I'm not going to disagree. Most people.
I think the line that's probably wrong by Jordan is the Pistons are undeserving champions.
Yeah,
and that's,
listen,
if I'm a member of the Pistons, I don't take that very well either.
No.
And so maybe that led to them walking off. But it is interesting, and you bring up the point I was thinking when I read the story right off the bat. Why is a writer the one telling us this so many years later?
Yeah.
Why isn't Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer on camera, which they've had all kinds of opportunities recently and over the years, why aren't they the ones saying, listen, what we did was wrong, but we felt like we had to do it at the time, or we don't regret it. Laimbeer basically said, I don't regret it at all. We did what we did. The Bulls are a bunch of whiners. But why wouldn't they bring that up?
Yeah.
They got nothing to lose by bringing it up. I mean, they already look like the villain and the bad guy, and most people are siding with the Bulls and Jordan because they're more popular than the Pistons in 89-90, obviously. They're the big bad villain, the big bad boys, which they enjoyed that, by the way. Sometimes you got to take the pros and the cons, and they enjoyed that bad boy image, and then all of a sudden now, years later, I think they regret a little bit of it. But why aren't they saying those things? Why aren't they saying, you know what? Jordan's the one that started it. Everybody's talking about us starting it. But listen, Jordan, you know, Isaiah Thomas goes back to 1988, but he doesn't talk about the day before game four?
Yeah.
So something, I don't know. I'd love to ask this writer, so are you the only one that has this information? Or why is it you that's breaking this information? Because why isn't Thomas Laimbeer or any other Piston, for crying out loud?
Yeah.
John Sally is on camera. Rodman could say it, too. He was a member of both teams.
Yeah.
I that's the thing that is perplexing to me.
Yeah, that's – and I don't know.
Is this just a big fan of Isaiah Thomas coming to his rescue?
I've never heard that was the reason before from anybody.
No, me neither.
Where does that come
from? So how do we go 30 years without that? It's interesting. But I'm sure Jordan obviously is pretty outspoken. We've seen that recently.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, I see both sides of it to an extent. I could see disrespected. But and I talked about it before. Two wrongs don't necessarily make a right. You could argue the Pistons started it, and then Jordan, of course, made it worse if he was, in fact, the one that kept Isaiah off the dream team. And so two wrongs don't make a right, although that wasn't team versus team. That was individual versus individual. Or you can go back now and say, if you believe this story from this Vincent Goodwill, then you can say, all right, Jordan, he's the one that started this thing by doing that and saying that, disrespecting the champion Pistons. And then you could argue, well, two wrongs don't make a right. The Pistons could have been the bigger of the two teams and could have done what the Bulls did the previous 2 years and said, hey, congratulations, even though reluctantly you say in your head, we hate you. But you're like, oh, okay, great job, good job. And I do get to this point, and I will say this, in defense of the Pistons a little bit, I think the problem, if the Pistons back in 1991, when they lost to the Bulls, if they just simply would have waited till the game was over and then walked out to the other side of the stadium or whatever, and they decided not to shake hands or say anything to the Bulls, I don't think that's really that big a deal, because that happens in sports a lot. Mm-hmm. In fact, the NBA
the Bulls were celebrating, so we didn't want to, we couldn't shake their hands.
You could have at that time. But at 7.9, the Bulls are all right there on the bench, and you walked right in front of them. And so that's what it looks so petty.
Yeah.
Is one, you didn't wait till the game was over. Two, you walked right in front of their bench. Three, you didn't even look at them. And Isaiah looks like a guy that's, hiding something, trying to get away with some kind of crime.
Yeah.
As he's, looks like bashfully heading out, like cameras aren't going to see him or something. I mean, though, just the way the whole thing was, the Pistons could have handled that better and still made their point. And that was, as soon as the horn went off, they just all turn around and walk to the locker room. But when you did it during the game, I mean, that just looks so much worse. And it's come back. As we said, what you reap is what you sow is what you reap. I mean, there you go. Here it is, all these years later, and we're supposed to feel sorry for Isaiah Thomas and the Pistons? I don't. I really don't. But I will say, I guarantee you, there was a fairly good reason why the Pistons did what they did. I don't think it was right. But at the same time, why would you not come out and say all the information to at least make yourself look a little better? Or is it just simply that Laimbeer and the Pistons just rather be that image no matter what for the rest of eternity, and they don't even want to bring up this comment that Jordan made because they don't want your pity?
Yeah, I
mean, I think Isaiah Thomas wants your pity. I don't think Bill Laimbeer does.
No, Bill Laimbeer doesn't care.
He don't care. So he said it.
That'd be a reason why he wouldn't even say anything about it. Why? Because he doesn't care. He's like, we're doing this. I have no regrets. Why would I 30 years later? That's what he said.
Yeah.
Why would I have regrets almost 30 years later about this? No, I did it then. I'll do it again now. He basically is what he said.
That's what I wish Isaiah would just do. He's kind of on the fence here and there, It's like, well, Laimbeer's idea, the Celtics did this 88, and didn't say anything about Jordan talking about in between these games as his writer does. I'd like Isaiah to just take, he doesn't come out, he came out with an apology. I saw the video. It was the next year, the Bulls and the Pistons play for the first time in 1992 after the Pistons pulled those shenanigans. And Isaiah Thomas was on camera with Hubie Brown. And he basically was saying, we don't have any regrets of doing it because that's how we felt at the time. But it was unsportsmanlike, yes. And we probably shouldn't have done it, yes, da-da-da-da. But he said the word but after each one of those.
Yeah.
And when you say but, you erase. I learned this a long time ago. When somebody usually says the word but after apologizing or during their apology, it erases everything.
Yeah.
Because what you're saying is, however, you're not fully taking responsibility. Isaiah Thomas doesn't still take responsibility for what happened. He admits they did it. He says, well, you know, it wasn't the right thing. But he just pick a side. Either be contrite and say, Michael, I'm really sorry, the Bulls, that I did this. Or just say, you know what? Be like Lambeer. Be like Lambeer. And to me, Isaiah Thomas is playing both sides of this thing and has for years. He wants to play the role of the victim, but yet he wants to be the bully. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's kind of how Isaiah Thomas was. You know, he kind of wanted to be a bully, but yet he wanted to be loved in a way.
I want people to feel sorry for me.
Exactly. I want people to feel sorry for me.
For what?
I apologize somewhat, but I'm not going all the way to apologize. I don't regret what we did, but yet I'm not fully saying that we don't care what you think. That's just Isaiah Thomas, apparently.
Yeah, it's him, and I think it's part of him might be like, I'm not getting enough of the limelight with all these other guys around me, with the Magics, the Birds, all these guys.
Oh, no, and, that's true. You know, there's something to that. He was a little guy.
Some jealousy
little guy.
In there, yeah.
Because think about it, at the time in the league, the big guys ruled the league. Because Michael, you know, Larry Bird was 6'8", 6'9", Magic was 6'9", and in a docuseries, Jordan, when he was drafted, there were people who said, 6'6 guy, you got to be a 7-footer to dominate in this league. So Jordan kind of changed that narrative a little bit, even though he was 6'6. But Isaiah was what, 6'6", 6'1"? He was a little guy that won a couple of championships. He was a lot smaller than Magic Johnson. So maybe that's part of that persona that Isaiah did when he was growing up. He was a little guy, and he was always, you know, probably made fun of because he was short. And the little guy had to be the big, tough guy. And he did that. But I commend him for what he was able to do. I remember watching him play. He played hurt. He was a gamer. He was a leader, and he was one of the ringleaders on the Bad Boys. I mean, he relished that role, and he got beat up too sometimes. But I just wish at this point in time, just pick a side, man. I mean, it just seems like to me he's straddling the fence. Would you agree?
He's trying to help his image now, and it's not helping.
Well, that's his image is long gone with all the things
it's like he's trying to rebuild it to help his image now for the people that don't know everything about this. You know, like
Larry Bird is a great player, but if he was black, he'd just be a good player. That was one of his comments. And Larry Bird was a member of the Dream Team in 92.
Yeah.
You think Bird would?
Larry did a really good job of shrugging that off and just moving on with it. But that still has to eat at you, no matter how you treat it in the media.
You don't think if it was asked of the guys on the team, hey, do you want to, we're thinking about Isaiah on this team, but we know that you guys have some issues with Isaiah, would you be okay with him being on the team? Do you think Larry Bird and Michael Jordan said, yeah, sure, bring him on, when we can get John Stockton or somebody else that's maybe just as good?
Yeah.
Isaiah made his bet. He's got to lie in a little bit. But it is interesting, some of this information starting to come out that we may or may not have known, but I just don't understand why this writer's the one to put this out there on Yahoo.
Kind of weird,
a guy I've never heard of, by the way, writer-wise. I don't know if he's a big Piston fan or Isaiah fan. And I'm not saying he's making up this story. It's just that why isn't Lambeer and Thomas saying, this would be the first, if I was defending myself, if I was Isaiah Thomas, Bill Lambeer, I would have brought this up like right then after it happened in 1991, and I'd keep up with that story for the next 30 years. I'd be like, listen, we probably shouldn't have done what we did, but we felt that way because we felt disrespected because go look at the quote Jordan said about us the day before. He said we're undeserving champions. Well, that ticked us off. So we were like, well, if he doesn't respect us, why are we going to respect them when they beat us? I would respect that.
Yeah.
So what's the big secret here? Apparently Vincent Goodwill's got the big secret. I don't understand why all those guys would be tight-lipped about that unless Vincent Goodwill has all this wrong. And Jordan never said that.
I did do a search here to see if I could find anywhere else, and there is a story from like 2007 that Sam Smith, who wrote the Jordan Rules book, that he has that quote in his story from like 2007, story about Isaiah Thomas when he was in New York, and, you know, that was not going well. And so apparently he said it, but I haven't heard that that's the reason why they did this before.
It would make sense. Now. You connect the dots, but why wouldn't they just come out and say that's what ticked us off and sent us over the edge to do that?
Yeah.
And you'd understand where they came from a little bit more. I mean, I would. Honestly, I would. Doesn't mean I'm still not a Jordan and Bulls fan, but I would at least understand a little bit more. Anyway. All right, Coach's Week. Who are we going to hear from today?
Yeah, Andy Nemchek, longtime Beloit Trojan wrestling coach. We can chat with him about his career and some of the highlights that he's had in his time there at Beloit. So enjoy that here today.
All right, and then tomorrow, Mike Weatherman, and Friday, Kurt Christians.
Welcome back on the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com. We are pleased to be joined by Andy Nemchek, head coach of the Beloit Trojan wrestling team. Has had a very successful career dating all the way back to the 1986-87 season with the Beloit wrestling program, and had a lot of years as an assistant football coach as well. We're going to talk about Andy and his journey. Coach, first of all, thanks for taking the time to join us. One of the first things I always ask is how did you get interested in the, first of all, you know, this kind of a wrestling focus, since you've had such a long storied career as the head coach there, but when did you first get interested in the sport of wrestling, and what were some of the things and highlights of your early life in the sport?
Well, I grew up wrestling. I grew up in Minnesota, and my brothers, I had two older brothers, they wrestled, and I'm sure that's what the influence that I had. So I wrestled in high school, and then I went on to, and wrestled in college. I wrestled at a small college in northern Minnesota called Bemidji State University, and I wrestled there in college. And so I've had wrestling in my background my whole life.
When did you decide that maybe you would want to go on and coach young kids and teach young kids and the sport, and then also just as a teacher as well?
I think my brother, I have an older brother that is a teacher and a wrestling coach, and I think that certainly was an influence on me. And I had some great high school wrestling coaches, and I think that those were definitely influences on me in my younger days. And I decided at that time that that's what I thought I wanted to do, is be a teacher and a coach, and it's worked out very well.
We'll talk in a little bit about how you ended up getting from Minnesota to Beloit, Kansas, but you did coach in Minnesota for a while before you came to Kansas, right?
I did. Right out of college, I coached several years on an Indian reservation in northern Minnesota, and that was quite an experience. And then I also coached at a large high school in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then I coached 1 year at a junior college in southern Minnesota. And the situation was that the coach that was at Beloit before me was a coach by the name of Chris Soans, and I had applied for a job in Minnesota, and so had Chris Soans, and we both were finalists for this job. It was at a large high school in western Minnesota, and anyway, Chris Soans ended up getting the job, and the athletic director at that school that hired him asked me, he said, if you're at all interested in moving to Kansas, he said, Beloit, Kansas is looking for a wrestling coach and PE teacher, and the rest is kind of history.
So you just kind of sort of flip-flopped and found out that he got the Minnesota job, so you come to Kansas. That's an interesting story.
Okay.
When you got to Kansas, did you kind of just fit right in? How long did it take to kind of acclimate yourself to the new surroundings?
Well, I fell in love with the area because I'm a very avid fisherman, mm-hmm. and hunter, and in this area, I knew nothing about Kansas. And the funny thing about me even coming here was the first thing I did was I knew very little about Beloit. I had wrestled in the NAIA championships in like 1980 at Fort Hays, and that was the only time I'd ever been to Kansas. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did before I decided to even apply for the job in Beloit was I looked on the map and I saw that there was a lake near Beloit. And that was probably the biggest influence why I even applied for the job, because coming from Minnesota, lakes are very abundant, of course, in Minnesota. And I grew up hunting and fishing and that kind of thing. And being near a lake was very important to me. So that was probably the biggest influence. And I fell in love with the area and the people here. And it's been very good.
So you get to Beloit and take over the wrestling program. Again, we're talking with Andy Nemchek, the head coach of the Beloit Trojan wrestling team. How long did it take before you were kind of enthralled and realized what kind of history this program had, with Ken Piazza winning five state championships, and then they won another one under Soans there in 1985. What was it like to be able to take a program over with that rich a tradition?
Yeah, there was definitely some pressure. together. I mean, I remember stepping into this program, and we had some really good teams in the first couple of years, and then things kind of went dry on us. We had trouble getting kids out in the early 90s, and Jeff Hyman was my assistant at that time, and Jeff was a longtime assistant with me for like 29 years. But we struggled in the early 90s. We struggled to get kids out to wrestling, and our program struggled, and we fought through the hard times, and things got better in the late 90s and the early 2000s. The program really took off, and we've had pretty good numbers out lately, and some really good talent.
I know you talk about the program taking off, and all over your time, you've taken home 4 state trophies, and obviously numerous wrestlers have made it to the state tournament, and you've had many state champions, 4 state trophies in all. I know one of the things you're proud about is your history as far as league is concerned, and really doing a nice job in the NCAA. And I know you were NCKL when you first came, right, and then moved to the NCAA, is that correct?
Yes.
So what was it like the transition with some of the differences you saw in the transition of the leagues and being successful in both of them?
Well, the NCKL League, of course, really rich in wrestling. Abilene has always been a power, and Marysville became a power in the late 90s. And Concordia was a big-time power with Doug Moore as a coach there and so on. So the NCKL League was very, very, very tough. And NCAA League, not so much. We have kind of dominated the NCAA League for the last 10 or 15 years.
You look at this, and we talk about, you're dominating in a sport as a team, but really, I mean, it comes down to individuals making a team in the sport of wrestling, because it's one-on-one matches. How important is it for you? You talked about, your numbers came back up there here, maybe late 90s, early 2000s, you started getting those numbers back up, but how important is it in a wrestling program for maybe people that don't understand that to have the numbers in the room and in the gym?
Well, it's so critical because, first of all, in dual meet competition, of course, there are 14 weight classes, and in order to compete dual meets, you've got to fill the weights. And it was tough for us in those lean years to win dual matches, because we weren't filling weights, we were stepping on the mat and forfeiting 3, 4, 5 weight classes, and you can't win a duel like that. But it's also critical in the practice room. You got to have quality partners to work out with every day. And in situations where you don't have those numbers, it's tough for kids to get much better when they don't have partners that can push them and work out with them on a daily basis.
And Coach, you did have 4 state trophies that you brought home as a team during your career there at Beloit, so far anyway, and 3-time regional champions. And obviously to be able to bring home a state trophy, you've got to have a lot of success at the regional tournament and be able to get kids to the state tournament. So what's, I guess, your philosophy when you head into a regional tournament like that?
Well, we always talk about setting goals. Our kids do, and we make them set goals before the season starts, and it's so important when we go to the region that the kids understand top 4 in the region, and that's every kid's goal is to be top 4 in the region and to qualify for that state tournament. And in order for us to do well at the state tournament as a team, in order to bring home a trophy, the more kids that we have in the state tournament, the more chance that we have of taking home a trophy, and it all boils down to that. And even if kids do not place in the state tournament, just winning matches is so important, and that team score adds up. Every time a kid wins a match, or every time they get bonus points for a fall or a technical fall or a major decision, that's critical. And we talk about those things all season about how to win tournaments and how to do things like that. So that's our philosophy, and kids understand that. And we tell kids all season long that everything up until the region is practice, and we are gearing ourselves always and trying to peak at that region and state tournament time.
As I said, you have four state trophies that you've brought home from the state tournament in 3-2-1A. The special season back in 2007 when you won a state championship there in 3-2-1A. Brad Esterl was a state champion, 40-140, and Matt Hyman also finished second. You had five medalists in that tournament, but you did bring home the big one that year. How did it feel to kind of, I don't know if you get the monkey off your back, but to be able to finally hoist that state championship trophy?
Yeah, it was very special. We, all season long, we knew we had a good team, and we didn't really know where we stood. We thought we could take home a trophy and that year. And, you know, it turned out that we got into basically a three-way race. It was us and Smith Center and Norton, and we ended up sharing the team title with Smith Center that year. It was a tie for the title. And it was just a very special season and a very special state tournament. I think we qualified eight kids that year, and I think we, as you said, I think we placed five kids. But we had some kids that were just wrestling out of their league, out of their to what they've been wrestling all year, and kids that we had been losing to in the season, in the regular season. We'd step out on the mat in that state tournament and we'd beat them. And we pulled some really big upsets, I thought, in that tournament. And that's what it did, you know. That's what made us win that state title, is some kids that really stepped up that we really didn't think, we didn't really count on. But when you're in a team race like that, kids do those extraordinary things, and we certainly had it that year that we had some kids that really, really stepped up. It was really, really exciting, and it's certainly probably the highlight of my career so far, that 2007 state title.
So you have had a lot of wrestlers that have made it to state, and obviously you've had a lot of state champions as well. I know at least 12 or 13 state champions since I've been here covering sports in North Central Kansas. But point being, you've had some success. What does it take, and what's the approach and the commitment that it takes for a kid to be able to be at the end, standing on that medal stand with the gold medal?
To be a state champion, you have to do something extra. And we tell our kids that. And we hold them accountable all season for their goals. And when a kid puts down as a goal for that season, they put down a goal that they want to be a state champion, we hold them accountable. During the season, if they're not working hard or they're not doing the right thing or whatever, we pull a kid aside and say, listen, you put down that you wanted to be a state champion, this is what you got to do. So we hold kids accountable that way. And also, it takes something extra. If the kids got to put in more than just practice time and hard practice time. They got to do some extra running on their own. They've got to do things in the off season that are so important. And the number one thing is they have to lift. Every kid has to get stronger every year. And we tell kids all the time, just because you're another year older, if you were a sophomore and now you're a junior, doesn't mean that you're going to be better. You have to make yourself better. And they do that in the weight room, and they do it through summer wrestling, going to camps during the summer. And that is very critical. And we've seen the results of that with Blaine Harris, who was with us a couple of years ago. He made himself into a state champion. He was just an average wrestler as a freshman and sophomore. And after his sophomore season, he decided that he wanted to go to be more than just an average wrestler. And he went to summer camps, and he put in probably got 20 to 30 matches in several summer camps that he went to. And the next year, he attributes his state championship that next year, his junior year, with this summer wrestling, and since then we've had kids see that happen, and we've had other kids that have done some summer wrestling, and I think it's really important that kids stay on it, just like any athlete. We tell our kids, you know, stay, be an athlete and be an athlete all year. Don't just take, there's no time off for high school athletes. You got to continue to compete and compete in other sports and lift and be an athlete your whole career, not just during the, during your season.
So, again, we're talking with Andy Nemchek, coach of the Beloit Trojan wrestling team. Coach, I know that one of the things that you've been able to do here in the past, and Zane Colson's a kid that comes to mind. He was a member of the cooperative from Rock Hills. He had a 39-0 season, won a state championship there at 152 a couple years back. But that's pretty special, isn't it, to be able to have different kids come in and be a part of the program as well, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. As you said, we've had some kids from St. John's in years past, and over the last 6 or 8 years, we've had 3 or 4 kids from Mankato Rock Hills come, they're a part of our team all season long, and when it comes to the region and the state, which is unfortunate, they have to wrestle for their home school, and that's unfortunate, but they are certainly a big part of our team this year. We have 3 kids from Mankato come and wrestle with us, and they do an outstanding job. And our kids accept them as part of our team. And with Zane Colson, Zane was just an outstanding athlete and an outstanding leader. And he's the only kid in all my years here that was ever elected. And we elect our team captains. And he was elected even as a freshman stepping into our program. I think our kids saw what a great leader he was, that he was elected by his teammates all 4 years that he was here to be a team captain. And I thought that was astounding. A kid from another school stepping into our program, and the kids thought that much of him to elect him as a team captain all 4 years. But they're a big part of our program, and we enjoy having them.
Also, Coach, you had a lot of success, and you probably owe that to a lot of different people. I know you've had a lot of great assistant coaches throughout your career as well, right?
Oh, we have. You know, Jeff Hyman, who was with me from almost the very start, was with me for 29 or 30 years until he branched off and did his barbecue business. Mm-hmm. But what an asset he was to our program for all those years, and what great rapport he had with kids. Jeff was a Beloit High wrestler back in the early 80s during the dynasty when Beloit was state champions 5 years in a row. He was part of that, and it was just amazing to have him on my coaching staff for all those years. Ryan Malay has been with the program for 14 years now, since 2006, and what a great asset he is to our program. And recently we picked up Wyatt Srolling, who is a longtime coach. He coached at Waukini for years, and then he coached at Russell for years, and then he retired and moved to Beloit, and we picked him up in the last 2 years, and what a great asset he is to our program. So, you know, these assistants make this team, and everybody brings their own skills and things to the table, and I can't say enough about the assistant coaches that I have and have had in the past.
And 29 years of your career, you're also an assistant football coach, so I'm sure you get a lot of great memories. You know, the 1996 state championship team, I'm sure, stands out for you, but what's the biggest thing, and touch upon maybe that and some of the big things and highlights of your football career?
Well, football was always good. I always looked upon it as a good recruiting tool for my wrestling, and you know, I think football and wrestling coincide with each other, especially linemen, and that's what I coached. I coached offensive line, defensive line, and offensive and defensive line play is nothing more than a 5-second wrestling match every down. So I really enjoyed coaching football, but after 29 years and it was time, I thought, to step out and to focus a little bit more on wrestling, and that was kind of the thing. In the final 8 or 10 years that I was coaching football, football and wrestling were overlapping because we would go so deep into the playoffs every year that we would sometimes have football still going on when wrestling started, and I would come out of football kind of exhausted and then step into a four-month wrestling season. So I also enjoyed being in football because my two sons played football, and I wanted to be part of that with them. So that was exciting for me also. But I really enjoy now having the fall off and being ready. When wrestling starts, I am ready to go and not coming out of an exhausting football season and not being ready. So very much enjoy that.
Andy Nemchek, coach of the Beloit Trojan wrestling team. Coach, I know things are a little bit different right now. You're still doing some teaching, obviously, but it's a little bit different setup now, isn't it, with everything going on? How are you holding up as far as making sure you're still educating?
Well, I'm holding up fine, just like everyone else. I worry a little bit about our sports programs, I mean, and all of them. Everybody's up in the air wondering, you know, when can we return to normalcy? And it's so hard because nobody has an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as our wrestling, as far as any summer wrestling or lifting, like I talked about, which is so important, you know, none of that is getting done right now. You know, I would prefer that our kids be lifting like crazy right now and getting stronger. And with a lot of kids, they don't have the equipment at home and that kind of thing to do that. But, we're in the same boat as everybody else, so it's not like other people are getting ahead of us on things. So we're just hoping for the best and trying to get along just like everyone else.
Andy Nemchek, coach of the Beloit Trojan wrestling team. Coach, we certainly thank you for taking the time to kind of reminisce about your career and all the good things and positive notes about it, and we'll look forward to chatting with you down the road. Best of luck as you continue on this journey.
All right. Thank you, Dusty.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.